With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Farm Bureau President urges Congress to address fire risks. California Farm Bureau President Jamie Johansen is calling for increasing the pace and scale of forest management, including employee livestock grazing and prescribed burns to reduce dangerous fuels and protect communities and the environment. Last month, Johansen testified in Washington, D.C. before a federal land subcommittee of the House Committee on Natural Resources. He told the panel, quote, "Given the extensive number of wildfire-related impacts in California, California Farm Bureau has vested interest in quality and quantity of forest management activities." That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report. And now let's get into today's show headlines. California Fairgrounds receive state funding. California fairgrounds have been getting more in use than just hosting their annual state and county fairs. They're a place for community to gather, particularly in times of need. Over the last few years, California has been struck by natural disasters, including extreme wildfires and flooding. These natural disasters have impacted many agricultural communities, and the local fairgrounds have served as a space to house first responders, evacuated families, and endangered livestock. The California Department of Food and Agriculture has granted $89 million to the Fairgrounds Resiliency Centers program. This funding will support infrastructure projects such as additional safe shelter spaces, kitchen and sanitation facilities, showers, and related improvements that will protect and comfort the people and families in times of need. CDFA Secretary Karen Ross says, quote, "This program is a prime example of the value of California fairgrounds. These grants will provide more than 46,000 square feet of new space for emergency sheltering, and they will position fairgrounds to offer their communities additional resources during climate-related disasters or emergency shelters." She added, "The enhanced fairgrounds will also provide a unique opportunity for their communities to engage in the use of the facilities for other services and activities throughout the entire year." Planning and construction is set to take place later this year. To view a list of the fairgrounds receiving the grants and their project plans, visit cdfa.ca.gov. And now here's Brian German with more agriculture news.
A cooperative project is seeking to discover more about thrip migration and how it impacts in patients' necrotic spot virus. Eric Morgan of Braga Fresh and member of the INSV Task Force described their efforts in collaborating with UC Cooperative Extension to better understand disease vectors.
So we have access to a really nice ranch up behind one of our ranches up on the hills on the west side of the Salinas Valley. And last week we installed a weather station, and I think this week Cooperative Extension is going to be going up and setting up some type of transect with sticky traps. And really the goal is to try to start to understand, you know, population dynamics, and that they're going to be vacuuming the flowers to try to get thrips out of there and then probably assay those to see what has INSV and what doesn't. So we can start to kind of figure out what's going on with the population. That's a little bit outside the scope of what the INSV task force is doing. This kind of a little side project that we thought about. And there's just not a whole lot known about thrips in general, especially the Western flower thrips. I mean, other than the basics. And so it's just trying to get, you know, where are the populations coming from? Are the overwintering populations or the nymphs that emerge from the soil, where are they picking up virus? Where is the virus coming from? Where are the reservoirs, you know, of the native plants that are in the hills? What are species that can host the virus over time? So just trying to take a more expansive look and try to figure all that out.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture will be hosting a webinar next week focused on organic production. The Zoom webinar will be taking place on Tuesday, June 6th, and will feature discussions focused on a variety of organic issues. Some of the information to be presented includes assistance opportunities for certification costs, risk management options and benefits for organic producers, and changes for producers required by the Strengthening Organic Enforcement Final Rule. Presenters include personnel from USDA's Farm Service Agency, Natural Resources Conservation Service, Risk Management Agency, and Agricultural Marketing Service. Other topics of discussion will include new grant funding for organic processors and brands, organic dairy assistance, and new wraparound support for transitioning and existing organic farmers. More information on the webinar is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination,
our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, experts are expecting the 2023 Farm Bill to end up a 2024 Farm Bill, and that will have different effects in different parts of the country. Former long-term Congressman Colin Peterson of Minnesota says farmers in the Midwest will fare better with a delayed Farm Bill than farmers in the South.
You know, I don't think it's a huge deal for us if we don't get a Farm Bill done. It's a bigger deal in the South because rice has got a problem. Their inputs have gone up more than other crops. Their prices have stayed flat. They're not up like corn and soybeans and so forth. They got a big problem. Peanuts also has a problem, not as big as rice, but somewhat similar. And then whenever you got rice and peanuts doing something, cotton is trying to ride along on their coattails, and cotton is very expensive. Rice and peanuts are not. So, you know, it's a bigger deal in the South to not have a bill than it is in the Midwest, in my judgment.
He made those comments during last week's U.S. Meat Export Federation Spring Conference. I spoke with him after his presentation and asked him to expand on his thoughts.
What are the reasons for that?
Well, the reason is that peanuts has big increases in input costs, and their prices have not gone up either. You know, so peanuts and rice, their prices have been pretty flat. Where corn and soybeans and wheat and other sorghum have gone up substantially from what they were. You know, so that's their argument, that their input costs have gone up, their revenue is flat, so they're being squeezed. You know, so that's the reason. Now, cotton, I'm not as big an expert on cotton as I am on the other two crops, but that's a different situation. So we gave them the Stax program, you know, mm-hmm. and that was supposed to be it. So now they want to go back to the old PLC plus Stax, and that costs a lot of money. So how that's going to get sorted out, I'm not exactly sure. But and then you've got a difference between the cotton in Alabama and Georgia, and cotton in West Texas.
Right.
You know, that's another issue.
Right.
As far as trade in the Farm Bill, Peterson had this.
The trade things in the Farm Bill are minuscule. You know, I mean, the MAP program is $200 million a year. You know, so in the whole scheme of things, it's not a big deal. The Foreign Market Development Program is $35 million. You know, and then we've got these GSM programs that finance exports into developing countries, and half of that goes to Latin America, and half of it goes to Asia, and it's a total of $1 billion of loans, which is also not, in the scheme of things, and not a huge thing. You know, I think there's people out there wanting to increase those things, but again, I don't know where the money's going to come from, and you know, they'll probably end up tinkering and making things work a little bit better, but that would probably be about it. Probably a bigger deal is, you know, what does the administration do in terms of promoting trade? And there's been some criticism that they haven't been doing what they should be doing. They haven't been putting enough emphasis on it. They have the money to do whatever they have to do or whatever they can do. And some people think that they're not doing as much as they should. There's no effort to get most favored nation or, you know, trade promotion authority. At this point, you're not hearing anything about that. So I think the best opportunity for exports and trade is with the administration.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, red meat exports provided some optimism during the recent U.S. Meat Export Federation Spring Conference. With more on that, here's John Harris.
While the U.S. red meat industry is facing challenges in 2023, exports provided some optimism at the U.S. Meat Export Federation Spring Conference in Minneapolis, according to USMEF President and CEO Dan Hallstrom.
We're in an environment with a lot of headwinds, be it Proposition 12 on the pork side. We have a bit of a declining beef supply. Despite all that, I think there's a real sense of optimism around demand. Demand's been strong for the last few years, and even in the midst of higher pricing on beef, for example, demand is still very, very good and very strong. It's always good to get the membership together, the nine sectors of membership, but I kind of came away with some renewed optimism amongst our constituents that we can carry into the rest of 2023.
One particular region of optimism is Mexico, which has seen growth in both pork and beef purchases this year. Keynote speaker Kenneth Smith Ramos, who served as Mexico's chief negotiator for the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, says it's a relationship that politicians should not take for granted.
There's $800 billion in trade overall between Mexico and the U.S., and in the ag sector, it's over $72 billion bilaterally. We really should send the message to the leaders that free trade in agriculture strengthens food security in the region, and that we should not, going forward, cause any disruptions in this flow of trade in both directions.
Also at the spring conference, former House Ag Committee Chairman Colin Peterson urged attendees to push trade to the front of the agenda for the next farm bill.
My experience, when people come into my office, they would talk about the farm bill, and they would talk about crop insurance, they talk about Title I, they talk about conservation, talk about rural development. And then at the end of the meeting, they'd say, oh, and by the way, we got to do something about trade. That was the extent of it. So you've got to get to these members of Congress, and it should be the first thing you talk to them about, not the last thing. And I think if you approach it that way, you can get some people to the table that are going to put this on the top of the agenda, not the bottom.
For more on the U.S. Meat Export Federation and highlights from the spring conference, visit usmef.org. For USMEF, I'm John Harris.
Thanks, John. And the National Pork Producers Council is pleased with the recent news that the U.S. Department of Agriculture confirmed plans for a Section 32 purchase of $50.1 million of pork for distribution to various food, nutrition, and assistance programs. Section 32 of the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1935 authorizes the Secretary of Agriculture to make commodity purchases, entitlement purchases, and disaster assistance using funds appropriated annually from U.S. Customs receipts. NPPC notes the U.S. pork industry faces challenging market environment, resulting in the worst 5 months of average losses in 20 years. And thus, this Section 32 pork purchase can provide much-needed support to the wholesale pork market and therefore the hog market, while also securing affordable, nutritious pork products for USDA recipient programs. More about this can be found on their website, nppc.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
You're listening to AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
GMOs? Genetically engineered? Bioengineered? What's what? Well, GMO stands for genetically modified organism. It's the common term many people use for foods created through a process scientists call genetic engineering. And you'll start seeing bioengineered on some food packages to let you know the product or some of its ingredients come from GMOs. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
An upcoming trade mission looks to expand opportunities in Japan. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. In just a few days, dozens of agricultural professionals and state ag leaders will head to Japan with USDA's Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs, Alexis Taylor. Japan is the fourth largest market for U.S. food and agricultural exports. In 2022, U.S. exports matched the previous record, totaling $14.6 billion, with exports of soybeans, dairy, and other products reaching new heights. The United States is vital to ensuring food security in Japan. While in Japan, trade mission participants will engage directly with potential buyers, receive in-depth market briefings from USDA's Foreign Agricultural Service and industry trade experts, and participate in site visits. The delegation includes a robust representation of the U.S. agricultural sector, including businesses, state departments of agriculture, and commodity groups. The trip is next week, June 5th through the 8th. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan. Among farmers and ranchers, an oral agreement and a handshake are often viewed as being worth more than a piece of paper. But these informal arrangements only work if all the parties involved get along. Just consider your own family arrangements. There are many life events that can cause friction between family members, triggering disagreements over existing operations. Will your informal arrangements hold up when life events unfold that cause friction or disagreements? What about when a parent dies? I've often seen family strife after the death of a family member that was the key person keeping peace in the family. And what about the situation where both spouses own an interest in the farming operation's land, equipment, or any entities that have been created? Individual co-ownership can lead to misunderstandings. Another situation is that of severe illness or disability. What happens if a parent still has control under an informal agreement but can't do the work anymore? The lack of a formalized arrangement for transitioning the farming or ranching business can cause real problems with the next generation. Also, oral agreements, how business revenue and expenses to be allocated among family members, can spell real trouble as family members age and new members take over. Formalizing agreements should be viewed as a way to keep the family farming or ranching operation intact from one generation to the next. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan.
Holstein Association USA classifiers travel a lot of miles, visiting farms and evaluating dairy cattle in barns across the country. The team is experienced, well-trained, and passionate about what they do.
We've got a great team. Their average tenure is 18 years on the job, so they're true professionals at evaluating dairy cattle. And while their primary focus is Holsteins, most of our classifiers just enjoy looking at cows of all breeds, and they just really enjoy looking at the cows, meeting the farmers, and seeing different operations.
So that's Lindsay Warden, Executive Director of Genetic Services for Holstein Association USA. She said the commitment to quality evaluations is why the organization now offers its joint classification services to more dairy cattle breeds. In addition to U.S. registered Holsteins and red and white Holsteins, the association has been classifying Guernsey cattle for the American Guernsey Association since 2018. This summer, milking Shorthorns and Ayrshires will be added to the lineup. Here's Holstein Association USA CEO John Meyer.
The more things we could do together, the better. And one of these things is joint classification. You know, it doesn't make a lot of sense to have different people going down the same country roads to classify four or five different breeds of cattle. And today, so many different farms have more than one breed of cattle. So the Ayrshire folks and milking Shorthorn people are very excited about this opportunity, and we are too, and hope to continue this and do more breeds all the time goes on.
The goal is to make classification more accessible for all breeds of cattle and offer farmers information they need to drive progress within the herd. American Milking Shorthorn Society President Marcia Clark.
As small breeds, we're all going to have to unite and work as one. Calling upon Holstein, that will help us save money, get more animals classified, and be able to know that we all can strive for the same goals at the end of having animals classified and registered.
Holstein Association USA classifiers attend annual trainings where they receive comprehensive education on evaluation criteria for all breeds. The classification team begins its first tour with milking Shorthorns in May and with Ayrshires in June.
It allows us to operate efficiently for the breed associations, efficient for the farm, and we're just really excited to have the opportunity to provide this service for these new breeds.
All totaled, Holstein Association USA provides classification services for five dairy cattle breeds. Learn more by visiting HolsteinUSA.com. For Holstein Association USA, I'm Bob Cervera.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
If your soil could talk, what would it say?
If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Grain traders are betting on normal rain in the Corn Belt by mid-June. I'm Mark Oppel with your bottom line report this first day of June, brought to you by Superior Livestock. December corn starts this month the lowest since January 7th of last year. November soybeans the lowest since July 7th of 2021. July Kansas City wheat back to lows from early April of 2021. All this pressure based primarily on forecasts for normal rain in the Corn Belt and Plains from June 7th to the 15th. Wheat has additional pressure, though. News that Russian farmers are holding twice the amount normal of wheat on their farms, over 12 million tons. So, important support levels? December corn, 508 here longer term, November soybeans, 1118, and July Kansas City wheat at 752. Live cattle futures look overbought, but we see no sign of a firm top. Cash cattle a year ago today, selling near $140, today near $178. Average Iowa-Minnesota hog weights, 2 pounds down from a week ago, down nearly 5 pounds from a year ago. Lean hogs look ready for a big rebound. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
Mexican trade officials are watching as U.S. lawmakers consider protections for specialty crop producers. Former chief trade negotiator for Mexico, Kenneth Smith Ramos, says the U.S. must remember to remain within the confines of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement.
What we see in Mexico is that because of the success that tomatoes, avocados, berries, and many other products have had in the U.S., there's of course the push in the United States to try to shut down that access. But if it's done in a way that's violating USMCA rules or WTO rules, then eventually this is going to lead to major litigation.
In an earlier interview, Florida Congresswoman Kat Kamick expressed concern over a lack of protection for U.S. produce growers. She used the example of tomatoes, which have had a suspension agreement limiting some tomatoes from Mexico since about 4 years after NAFTA was put into effect.
What we have seen, though, is a lack of enforcement.
I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
A new addition in the battle to protect our nation from animal disease threats is now ready to operate.
Welcome to Manhattan, Kansas, to Kansas State University, and to the grand opening of the National Bio and Agro Defense Facility, otherwise known as NBAF.
Kansas State University President Richard Linton was among those attending this event, one that has been well over two decades in the making. Also part of the dedication ceremony, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack.
The research that's going to be done here is, in fact, critically important to protect American agriculture.
I'm Rod Bain. A look at the history and the mission of NBAF is the subject of this edition of Agriculture USA. The National Bio and Agro Defense Facility, NBAF for short, was first conceived from two circumstances. First, the condition of our country's then top animal disease defense facility.
We understood that we were operating a 50-year-old lab at the time, the Plum Island Animal Disease Center, and it was aging, and we needed a new laboratory, and we needed to expand our capabilities for food ag vet defense.
Julie Brewer is an executive director within the Department of Homeland Security's Science and Technology Directorate. DHS operates Plum Island. And the agency's realization about Plum Island's status was made in 2005. Before that, though, the 9/11 terrorist attacks of 2001. As U.S. Senator from Kansas Jerry Moran recalls,
as a result, a commission was appointed by President Bush to make recommendations about what needed to be done. It resulted in a presidential directive to develop a plan to provide safe, secure, and a state-of-the-art agricultural biocontainment capacity and capabilities for research and diagnostics.
The call for locating NBAF occurred in 2006. And after a very competitive process among 29 bids, Manhattan, Kansas was awarded the site in 2009. Former U.S. Senator Pat Roberts was among those leading the efforts to locate the facility in his home state.
We still must be prepared for a threat that could have been disastrous over 20 years ago, and I believe still remains. It is so easy to do, and the consequences are so terribly severe, short and long term. That is why we have NBAF.
Groundbreaking at the site, adjacent to Kansas State University, began in 2015. The recent dedication of NBAF signaled the start of new approaches. On the science side, our nation's first maximum biosecurity containment center to allow study of large agricultural animals and the highly pathogenic diseases that threaten them. DHS's Julie Brewer also notes a biologics development module researching various animal disease vaccines and countermeasures.
And we work with our USDA partners that are doing a lot of that early stage research, and then we target research to advance those more quickly to market.
While DHS operates the Plum Island facility, the Agriculture Department will own and operate NBAF. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack recalls the management agreement arranged between USDA and the Department of Homeland Security and its then Secretary, Janet Napoliano.
She was anxious and interested to explore a partnership where DHS would be accepting responsibility for the construction of this great facility. But man, when the real work began, they'd like to transfer that responsibility to the Department of Agriculture.
The Agriculture Research Service and Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service will share operational responsibilities of NBAF. These are the respective agriculture undersecretaries leading those mission areas, Shavonda Jacobs-Young and Jenny Moffitt.
I know our ARS scientists, they have the spirit of partnership. And with APHIS, we have the perfect 1-2 punch. We're going to help diagnose what's happening. We're going to help mitigate, and we're going to take care of it.
The lab network that APHIS has really is anchored here at NBAF by the work that is going to be done at NBAF, by the work that's being currently being done as well at Plum Island.
With existing Plum Island research being transferred to the National Agro and Biodefense Facility, several agree partnerships in research and communications will be essential to NBAF. With that facility, Kansas State University and the Kansas-Missouri area known as the Animal Health Corridor serving as an example. As K-State President Richard Litton explains,
our country needs a state-of-the-art facility that performs cutting-edge research to protect our food supply and create solutions for animal disease health. We're moving away from silos to interdisciplinary work that allows us to identify problems and develop solutions much more rapidly.
This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Welcome back to the show. Today we have an interview with California Farm Bureau's first Vice President, Shannon Douglas, who is also one of the co-founders of CalAg Jobs. We talk all about today's career opportunities within the ag industry. Today we're in Modesto for a great event talking all about agriculture and really promoting the future of ag. And so that's kind of what I want to talk to you today about and how our future of the industry might be shaping and changing and as we maneuver through changing regulations and all that comes with the industry. First off, for folks who maybe might not be familiar with CalAg Jobs, why don't you go ahead and give us an overview of what that is? So what we are is we started about a decade ago, and we do kind of two things. We are either promoting career opportunities to companies post jobs with us, and we help promote those for jobs that are focused on agriculture, really anywhere in California or if they can be based in California. And then we also do recruiting for companies who need some additional support getting those roles filled. Because of course, it's kind of challenging right now in the HR world these days.
What might be some trending positions, or is it just kind of all over the place right now where you're seeing job opportunities?
I would say right now it is really all over the place. Everything from management roles to sales roles, and there still are some impacts from COVID where people are looking to move around a little bit. And perhaps if they were in more of a sales role and did a lot of travel, and they're looking to do less of that and spend more time with their families now, and so looking at more, could they go into some farm management type roles? But it is really a wide range right now, and there is just so much opportunity for people in agriculture. And especially for, you know, young people that are looking at where they want to take their careers, we want to have them in ag.
You went over some statistics about the opportunities that are available to students and or young adults that are coming right out of college. Go over those statistics and talk a little bit more about the opportunity there.
Absolutely. So we have tons of opportunity in agriculture for young people, but for people making career transitions, whatever they might be, but especially for these young people today who are looking at what do they want to do for a career, and we want them in agriculture. So that, like nationwide, we're looking at about 2 jobs for every graduate coming out of college, and that doesn't include our community college students, so those numbers aren't a little imperfect, to be clear, but there's great opportunities there. And then we look in agronomy in California, then we're looking at about 4.6 or 4.7 grads per student coming out with a plant science related degree. So their opportunities are just so immense. And I had mentioned to some this morning as well that earlier this week I was at Fresno State, and they've got their innovation and their incubator program looking at some amazing water technologies. And not only are they looking at, there's people, and often they are young people looking at an old idea from a new approach, or an old problem often from a new approach. But they're the ones coming up with, what if we tried it this way? What if we did it this way? And so not only do we need the people to think about those things for our industry, we also need the people who are going to go, okay, well, that's the creation, but now how do we apply it? How do we make this work on a farm? And how do we make this boots on the ground practical? So we really, not only do we need them in these roles, but we really need their thinking and their creative minds, and their new ideas are going to be so important for us.
Right, especially as we think about technology, robotics, automation, mechanization, and how that is impacting the ag industry and really changing the way that production ag is happening. Those are key jobs that we really need this next generation who are very tech savvy to kind of go into. You talked about the ripple effect, at least the economic ripple effect of the ag industry. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, definitely. And Modesto Junior College, the center of excellence, at least used to be hosted here. I'm hoping it's still there. I couldn't quite see the nods confirming it was. But they did a great study approximately a decade ago. And they were looking at, we know that the number of people who are producing the food, we know that the farmers is a smaller percent than it used to be. And that's, of course, changed over time. It used to be 2%. Now it's between 1 and 1.5%. But the people involved in agriculture is so much larger. So when they took a look at the whole value chain and all of the jobs that are generated, they really found that it was somewhere between 12 and 14% of the jobs in California are tied to agriculture. And that's the processing, the truck driving, but that's also the support services and the lending, et cetera, that are all needed to make that production happen. And so it really is a huge part, especially somewhere here like the Central Valley, where it's even larger in these counties.
That's right. Another thing that you mentioned is the cost of production and how that's increasing. With Farm Bureau, I'm sure you hear a lot about that and how you're advocating for that. And you can kind of take both hats, your CalAg jobs and your Farm Bureau hat. How are you inspiring the next generation when things are put up against our future generation, like the input cost and the cost of just doing day-to-day activities that's increasing? So how do you inspire the next generation to stick around, because the industry is that good to stick around for?
That is such a great question, and we talk a lot about it. Even I can remember a conversation recently with one of our board members, and we both talked about wanting to make sure our children feel like they can come back to the farm and that they want to, that they want to be involved in this industry. And I think there's several pieces to it. One, there's some realization of they're going to look at things differently, and that's what we want, actually, because we need someone to have a new approach to a problem that's already there, and how can we look at it differently? And they do think about things differently. Just that's how they grew up and their expectations and time, etc. But that is so critical, and making sure this is where they want to be. And sometimes that's our own dialogue. I mean, I talked to the group today about the regulatory cost increases that we've felt in agriculture, and that's just the regulatory costs. That's not all of the other input costs that we know are up as well. But knowing that those are challenges, but we want to make sure we see a way forward. And I think even talking to our kids in terms of what does that look like, and knowing there are challenges, but there is a way through it, just like it was for our parents and grandparents and predecessors. I've thought a lot lately on, as we're hopefully out of a drought, and I guess it depends on who you talk to, but now we have the problem of too much water that we haven't seen in so long. But if you talk to a rancher, whether they have sheep or cattle going through a drought, it means you make really tough decisions because you have to. And so you cull the ewes and the cows that you might not have otherwise, and you really decide what's the most important, what do we need. And that's how we have to look at these problems is, yes, tough times are going to make us make tough decisions, but we want tough decisions to happen. And maybe it forces us to do things we wouldn't, but it forces us forward. And that's what we want to do. So I hope we emphasize the positive things for our kids and providing that opportunity for them.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
How are GMO plants made? First, scientists look for a desired trait in a plant, animal, or even bacteria. It could be a trait like resistance to drought, insects, or viruses. Then they copy the gene that contains that trait and insert it into the DNA of the plant they want to improve. Scientists then grow that plant to see if it adopts the desired trait. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. California's Crop Progress and Conditions Report. For the week ending May 28th, the state saw mild temperatures to round out the spring season, and the snowpack in the Sierra Nevada was still heavy compared to this time last year. The state's reservoirs are all at 51% or more of their capacity. There was no major changes to the drought conditions, as roughly 96% of the state was considered without drought or in a region coming out of drought. Compared to previous years, rice growers were behind in planting, but are reporting more expected planted acreage than last year. Across the San Joaquin Valley, farmers cut, dried, and baled alfalfa, wheat, and oats. Corn for silage and cotton continued to be planted. Corn and Sudan grass fields were sprayed for weeds, and down in Southern California, farmers harvested their wheat straw. Across the state, grapes were sprayed for weeds and mildew. Stone fruits, including plums and nectarines, continued to develop. Apricots and early peach varieties were harvested. Peaches for processing were treated for pest and disease. Some citrus was wrapping up harvest, while others were netted to prevent pollination. Bee apiaries could be found in kiwi groves and melon fields. Dates continued to ripen. Cherry harvest began. Olives were treated for nematodes. And blueberries and strawberries could be found at roadside stands. And again, thanks to that nice weather, nut growers got to catch up on fertilizing and weeding orchards. Many growers treated their orchards for navel orangeworm and other pests. More walnut orchards were removed. Some pistachio growers treated their orchards for bugs. Almonds were also treated for nematodes, and all nuts continued to mature. Delay continued for Sacramento Valley farmers wanting to plant their cherry tomatoes. But down in Tulare County, sweet corn, eggplant, okra, onions, broccoli, cabbage, peppers, and garlic continued to grow. The transplanting of tomato and sweet potato fields also continued in Stanislaus County. For more on this, visit nass.usda.gov.
The GRN4 rootstock is standing out in Central Valley research trials by not standing out. UC Cooperative Extension Viticulture Advisor for Madera, Merced, and Mariposa counties, Carl Lund explains that the attributes of GRN4 could make it a consistent choice for growers.
Often I don't mention GRN4 that much because it just kind of sits there and doesn't do anything crazy. And for me as a researcher looking for, hey, what's standing out, you know, GRN2 with its, you know, lack of water stress, that stands out. GRN3 with its sudden water stress stands out. But then we have GRN4 that just sort of sits in the middle. It doesn't get super water stressed ever. It doesn't stay low water stress, but it doesn't get high water stress. It just stays in that, you know, normal middle group. It has, you know, canopy growth that stays in the middle. It's not super big. It's not super small. It's just got a good canopy. And then actually the one thing we haven't talked about at all is yields. And again, GRN4 just has a decent yield. So that kind of keeps it as just this, it doesn't stand out for me. And honestly, that actually might be a good thing for growers because it doesn't do anything super unusual or super crazy. So it's just kind of this consistent rootstock that always chugs along and it is always nice.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
AgCareers.com to hold a roundtable conference. What started in 2003 with just a few ag stakeholders has now turned into an annual full-scale event for agriculture food employers, educational institutions, and related associations. The AgCareers.com Agriculture and Food HR Roundtable Conference will be held next month on August 2nd through the 3rd in Denver, Colorado. It's an opportunity for agricultural employers, higher education ag educators, supervisors, governmental representatives, and industry-related associations to network, learn from presenters about trends in agriculture and food, career preparedness, and recruiting, as well as discuss some of the challenges and successes when it comes to the workspace. The roundtable conference will include 2 days of educational breakout sessions, keynote speakers, networking receptions, panel discussions, takeaway handouts, and access to research data and findings. To learn more and to register for the event, visit agcareers.com.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.